nine times out of 10, when someone is taking the time to break away and do their own thing, it's because they either have a specific point of view or a specific passion that really sort of speaks to maybe not a mass audience, but the customers that I have and the customers that Barterhouse tries to culture and cultivate, I think are those type of people who want that story and feel like if they take an allocation of an 80 case made wine, that they've got something special and it's something that only they have or maybe one other person has. So that's kind of what we specialize in. And, you know, it may not be business savvy to the nth degree, like we're not making 100,000 cases of Pinot Grigio and, you know, flogging them all over New York. But the customers that get wine from us are kind of believing the same stuff we do, which is supporting these small farms, supporting these young winemakers who have a passion for doing it. And we supply them with a market and we allow them to get their product out there to otherwise an untapped group of people.
Happy New Year and welcome to Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network, coming to you Tuesdays from around 12, I guess, to 12:45. It's Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues, here with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. Nice. They have new features in the radio today. That's awesome. I love that. That's for the New Year. For all you people listening, those are the New Year sound effects. Call in all your questions too, 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128 for all your cooking-related questions, technical or not. And Jack, I hear we have a caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing? I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you.
I have a question about using whipped cream chargers for rapid infusions.
Right.
I was wondering if it could be used to infuse and make flavored vinegars.
Yeah, I don't see why not. Yeah. I've never tried it, but I don't see why not. We've done oils before. You know, but just, you know, for quickly, for people who don't know what we're talking about, a rapid infusion is a technique where we take nitrous oxide cartridges, usually in these ISI, these whipped cream makers. So you can look them up under cream siphons or whatever on the or whippers on the internet. Some people use them to get high. We don't. I don't particularly enjoy the nitrous high. And they, under pressure, basically force liquid into porous items. Then you rapidly release the pressure. The liquid boils out, and you flavor your liquid. And so the question, and I normally do it with liquor, but the question is, can you do it with vinegar? And I don't see why not. Have you tried it yet?
I haven't tried. I'm waiting on my whipper to get here. I just ordered it through a friend of mine in a restaurant, so I'm trying to get it the cheap way through him.
Right. Here's some guidelines. That whenever I do water-based, and essentially I don't think that the vinegar is going to enhance the solubility too much of most of what you're working with. I don't think it's going to hinder it, but I don't think it's going to help it. So in general, when I do water-based work, you're going to have to use probably a little bit more of the product, and then you're probably going to have to let it sit a little bit longer. Every ingredient that you use has different kind of optimum infusion time. And so, you know, for chocolate, I find it's somewhere like a minute and a half or so. I mean, it all depends on the product. Some people I know do coffee for, you know, many minutes up to hours. Some people I know even overnight on something like coffee, you know, cold. And so you're going to have to play with your amounts and how long you leave it in. But I would definitely do it longer than any of the stuff quoted on the blog for liquor. And I would also, you know, take heed of the comments that people said that, you know, you're going to want to wait, several minutes after you vent it for the flavor to fully develop. Because I think that really is, I don't know why, but I really think it's a real phenomenon.
Okay, cool. Could I ask one more quick question?
Sure.
The same lines. What about using them to with cucumbers inside of it to kind of make a quick pickle in the charger? Do you think that would work?
It does. It doesn't work as well as a vacuum does.
Okay.
At least I don't think. I mean, I haven't done. I mean, I tested it once. It works, but you know, I think. Do you have a vacuum machine or no?
I do not, no. Yeah.
All right, well, then it's probably going to be one of the better things you can you can do. Another way to do those kind of flash infusions, and we call them quick pickles too, but you have to be careful because when you're pickling, you're actually kind of doing an exchange of fluids, and with all of these rapid infusion techniques, you're not exchanging any fluids, right? You're just injecting fluids into what used to be air holes. So you're gonna need a fairly strong flavor base to do it, and you're also going to need not think of them as being preserved in any way, and they also things like cucumbers tend to get floppy because you inject it right away, and there hasn't been time for osmosis to kind of start up and for the actual cucumber cells to leach out their liquid, because you're going to put something in that's high in salt, let's say, and or sugar or both, and the liquid is going to start migrating out of the cells of the cucumber, and it's going to start getting floppy. So for like really crunchy, crisp results, you're not going to want to let the stuff sit around a while, and it will work. If you're going to do it that way, though, I would say rather than use it the way that we say, I would make it cold, so that it doesn't bubble out as much when you're releasing it. Because the goal is to keep liquid in and not to have it kind of bubble out. If that makes sense.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, thanks. I'll post up on the blog with the vinegars if they work out well and let you guys know.
No, cool. Yeah, I hope so. I hope it works out for you. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
So, on a non-cooking related note. We just spent the last 10 minutes brushing muck off of my anyway, it turns out that here in New York City we had some snow, not a lot really by normal standards, but for some reason like they decided not to plow it, and Manhattan they totally cleaned out, so I was like, oh, it's safe to take my bike that I shattered the rear fender on just before Christmas and haven't had time to fix because I'm lazy and stupid. And so then I rode across, and of course as soon as I get over the bridge in Brooklyn, it's like mucky snowmobiling on my bike, and so like my entire backside is sprayed with muck. That has nothing to do with anything. Okay, on to real cooking issues questions. By the way, we had some people ask us how our holiday. We're both Christmas folks, so how was our Christmas and New Year's? Excellent. Yours, Nastasha?
It was good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Not excellent.
Not. It was good.
Good.
Yes.
Oh, all right. Okay. Then with that, I will get right to the questions. So a while back, Thanksgiving time, we had a question from a listener who asked why he wasn't dead, because his mom used to basically take turkeys and salt them and put them out to in the kind of the back porch to kind of cure for a couple days, not under refrigeration. And the question is why not death? Why didn't death ensue? And I think it has a lot to do with kind of the air drying effect that happened on it, and the salt levels and the herbs and XYZ, all these things kind of go to stop kind of bacteria from growing on the outside, which is where most of it's going to grow because the inside's sterile, yada yada. Go back and listen to the podcast for the gory details. But we had someone write in, Mark Rosenblatt, also from Brooklyn, says that his mom used to do that in Long Island, but not with turkeys, did it with ducks, and would do the same thing with duck. And so I will relate what he says. He said he grew up in Riverhead in eastern Long Island in the 50s, and duck farms were plentiful, so his mom would cook the ducks instead of turkey and fully prepare two or three ducks 2 days beforehand and left them to cure outside and wonder why they never got sick. Her technique was if she would put whole cloves of garlic inside, which are antimicrobial, I would never trust it to be antimicrobial, but it is. Rub the exteriors of the duck with a thick mixture of olive oil and crushed garlic. Of course, that's actually like poison waiting to happen. Could be poison waiting to happen from a botulism standpoint, but probably not. Anyway, I mean, like, that garlic oil is one of the can be a dangerous thing. Anyway, then coated the entire bird in a blanket of coarse kosher salt, thereby stopping any botulism from happening, and wrapping the duck in wet newspaper because he used to deliver newspapers. And so the newspaper would dry out, and his brother once ate the newspaper and got really sick. And so his question is with the newspaper, the wet newspaper, which does dry out, would that somehow kind of be a host for the bacteria and stop it from growing on the duck? I don't think so, because you never want any kind of host for bacteria if you can help it growing next to something that you're going to eat. Like, there's no beneficial protection from the newspaper. I wonder whether or not the sickness was because of some sort of poison in the ink, like lead or some sort of crazy nonsense in the ink. I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question, but I definitely wouldn't eat the newspaper in the future. But the newspaper, even if it's wet, if it's placed against a lot of kosher salt, you shouldn't get too much bacterial growth on it. I think the salt is really what's – by the way, these ducks were rinsed very thoroughly after they were cured, before they were cooked. I shouldn't think that the newspaper would help, but it is interesting that your brother got sick. I wonder whether – who knows? Poison maybe? What do you think? But yeah. If he knew if it was a GI situation, it was a GI. But very interesting. Thank you for writing in. Okay, now a question about venison. Hello, hope you had a good holidays. We did. This is from Andy. He says he was lucky enough to take down a deer. He's a bow hunter, and he took down a deer this year. And he's elbows deep, he says, in venison, and he's psyched about it. He patched together a circulator, a DIY circulator. The circulator, you know, is what we use to cook things at very accurately precise temperatures, usually in a water bath, but sometimes in fat or oil. And he wants to do a boneless venison loin as his first big meal out of it. And then, are there any differences in the temperature or timing for this as opposed to beef? And he's thinking about 55 degrees Celsius for about an hour or a little longer. Any thoughts? Andy, I think that sounds about right. That's just about the right temperature. Even a shade lower, like 54.5 or something like that for a tenderloin, usually in beef. I should think the venison would be about the same. The trick with venison in general is, I don't know how old the animal you got was, but if there's any sort of tendency to a livery taste in the meat at all, which there shouldn't be in the loin, but, you know, in other cuts of the venison, you're definitely going to not want to cook it for too long, or those livery notes can be accentuated. Sometimes, like when we cooked yak for a long time, those livery kind of notes, gamey notes, actually kind of, I think, worked with the meat, but I don't know that you necessarily want that in the venison. The only other question is that some meats can feel tender, but then, you know, when you cook them, they're tough even at these low temperatures. But I should think that a venison loin isn't going to be that tough. I would cook a small piece of it at 55 for an hour and see whether you like it. I wouldn't go much longer, because if it does cook like beef, which I'm assuming it probably will, then it's going to start getting kind of fibery after that and won't be as good. But please write in and tell us how it is, and I'm curious to hear how your homemade circulator works out. Okay. We had another question. This is an anonymous question. He said, why does an egg that we stored in a mason jar with white truffles not coddle properly? The yolk was cooked perfectly, but the white didn't set up at all. The egg was not very old. If anything, it was only around a week old. Jeez, I never heard about this. I did a preliminary web search, and scientific literature search. I couldn't find any sort of active principle in truffles that would stop an egg white from setting. My only theory is that it was stored at room temperature, which would accelerate the breakdown of the white to a thin white and make it so it doesn't set as nicely in a coddled preparation. But other than that, I can't see why a white wouldn't set, whereas the yolk would, because typically the white would set much earlier. White would start setting in and around 60 degrees Celsius at 140 and be, you know, basically custardy, nice set at around 62 degrees Celsius. And then the egg wouldn't start setting, the yolk wouldn't start setting up until, it would be runny at 62 and would start setting up at 63, get creamy, and then get get really firm around 65 or so. Now, there's so many recipes for truffled omelets that I'm curious. It's got to be some sort of weird something going on. Like, was the mason jar at room temperature? I can't think of anything. Anyway, but I will definitely ask around. And if any of our readers have heard anything, please tell us. The other interesting point that this anonymous caller brings up is that they cook udon noodles at salad for a brunch, and they toss it in Meyer lemon vinaigrette. They had some left over, and so they decided to dehydrate it and then puff it. And they noticed that the ones that had been soaking in vinegar seemed to puff more than the normal ones that had just been cooked and blanched and left out and tried. And so is there any question, why would they puff bigger with the acid? And I have no idea, actually. It's interesting. I did a preliminary research on that, and I couldn't find anything specifically with acid and puffing, but it might be possible that there's some sort of effect. I mean, acid obviously weakens gluten, but I don't know if it's going to weaken gluten in products that have already been cooked or not. So if you somehow are weakening the gluten structure and the udon hadn't been completely overcooked, because remember, when I puff anything, I overcook the bejesus out of it. So perhaps there's some sort of weakening there, and perhaps then it only works on wheat versus on wheat-based noodles versus, for instance, puffing like a tapioca starch or something like that. That would be the kicker. If you did a test and you said, okay, look, I'm going to do a buckwheat noodle. Of course, that has, you're going to put wheat in that too. If I'm going to do like tapioca or some other kind of noodle and puff it with an acid and see whether that also works. Then if it also puffs more with an acid in that situation, then obviously it's not the gluten. But I hope this anonymous reader will give us some more information, because I'd like to experiment on this more. I love observations like this. Maybe we'll learn. Maybe we'll all learn something, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Here we have a caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi, Dave. This is Colin Gore down in D.C.
Howdy.
I called in a couple weeks ago asking about, you know, possibly using some Pectinex to clear up some sweet potato.
Yes. Have we talked about that? Because we ran some tests. I couldn't get it to work, even with a centrifuge. Did you get it to work?
So I got, basically, I've been toying with it. I have never, I've seen a lot of interesting things that, you know, it wasn't what I was going for, but now I'm calling in to, like, maybe get some tips on where to go from here.
All right, so what was your experience? Tell me what you did.
All right, so what I did was, first thing I did was ran just the sweet potatoes through, my roommate had a Champion juicer, so that was perfect. I had never juiced anything that was like a tuber before, but it was, so I wasn't expecting a whole lot, because they're not like nice and juicy, seeming like an apple, but still got like maybe 60% yield.
That's
which
pretty
is
good.
Pretty sweet.
It's pretty good.
At least compared to what I was expecting, right? And then, so once you have the juice, I had it in a glass jar, right? And you could see that there was a lot of starch settling out.
Right. You get like a white starchy powder at the bottom.
Well, the funny thing is you get like a white starchy powder and then stuff that is kind of like acts like starch but is also more like orange,
right.
Like the potato.
Right, like so that mixed layer.
The cells were still kind of adhered to some stuff. I don't know.
Right. I know what you're talking about. We had the same thing happen. Then what'd you do?
Then first time, I just hit it with some additional amylase, some additional, I can't remember if it was alpha or beta. Yeah.
From a brewery supply?
Amylase, from the home, like at homebrew stores, they sell a little.
I think they're mixes. I think they're actually mixes of alpha and beta amylase, but
okay.
I'm not sure. I'd have to go look it up. But
Yeah. And then, I don't have my notes in front of me, but then I, put it in, sealed it up in a mason jar, put it in a circulator bath to a kind of lower mashing temperature to try to convert a lot of the starches over to sugars, because it was going for like a sugary syrup to simmer down into a caramel.
Right.
Right. And
how much of the starch did it eat? Did you agitate it?
No, I left it sit because I wanted the starch to settle out to the bottom so I could kind of decant the stuff off.
Right, but the amylase, if you had agitated, would actually help break down some of the starch, no? Although maybe not if it's locked.
That'd be a good plan, yeah.
I mean, what I would do, like before we go further, because I want to hear the rest of it, what I would do in the next test, I would cook this starch out a little bit, then cool it, then add the amylase, because then you could burst it. Because the amylase might have, if you have intact cells in there, the amylase is going to have trouble getting to the starch, maybe, unless it's been cooked out a little bit. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
What kind of temperature range would you say for that first step?
Ooh, I don't know. I'd have to go look at my, a good book is the, for starches in general and pasting and all that is Egan Press has a book on
Egan
starches.
Press,
Yeah. I mean, they're great series of books, all of those.
I got the Hydrocolors one a while back.
Yeah, their starch book's pretty good. Their starch book's good. Their nutritive sweetener book's pretty good. And you can get them all for $99 online, actually, if they still run that deal. It's hard to find, but you can get them all. So then what'd you do? You settled it out, and then what the stuff taste like?
Well, so actually the interesting thing was, I had left it to mash out for a good long time just to, partially because I didn't come back for a day. And unfortunately what had happened is the water bath had evaporated below the temperature probe, so it ended up just boiling the hell out of that shit.
First rule of running a circulator, folks out there in internet land, is always cover your circulator so that you don't, especially on a long cookout, to not evaporate all your liquid off. It's a classic problem. Yes. Well, the good news is that you'll never do that again.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I'm just glad I caught it in time before I burnt. Burn out the heating coil or anything, but the magic thing is that It looks like this boiling step at the end has caused the kind of sugary, syrupy water to separate out in a way that I have not been able to replicate since.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I figured, it was just sort of setting the starches and sort of at the bottom there.
Yep.
And, yeah, that was the only time that I was able to get a very nice kind of translucent caramel out of it.
This is very interesting to me. You got to try to replicate it. I had the same thing happen once. The worst thing in the world is when you're cooking and you do something wrong and aren't able to, replicate it, and you love the result. This has happened to me.
Yeah.
I made a durian caramel by accident in a pressure cooker that was incredible. Like, had no sulfur note, tasted like durian, but wasn't offensive to, the most mild Western noses. Awesome, rich, not burnt. And we went through probably 15 durian trying to get that back, and we've never been able to do it. So I wish you better luck with the... We should try some. We'll try some of the beta amylase and alpha amylase to see that we can replicate. But I definitely wish you more luck in replicating it. And you should call back again and tell us what happens. Right now, though, we have to. I'm being told that I have to go to a break. We're going to a break. But call back and tell us what happens, Colin. We're interested in it. Cooking issues.
Oh, how you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?
Feeling good.
Made so much bone, brother. How you feel, man?
I'm feeling
all right. I call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, fella? Right. Hey, yeah! Sure getting down. Look at him! Ha. We're gonna have a bunk good time. 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 Let's take him up, Fred.
And welcome back to Cooking Issues. Call in all your cooking questions to 718-497-2128, 718-497-2128. Jack in the control room tells me that we might be able to go a little bit long today because we had some questions come in over the New Year's break. By the way, speaking of New Year's break, I know we have not been writing a lot. When I say we, I mean me, have not been writing a lot in the blog recently. I just wanted to spend some time with my family over the holidays, all right? No, we're going to get back on the stick, and I'll be writing some stuff real soon, we hope. So please, no hate mail about how I haven't been writing anything. Okay, speaking of sweet potatoes, we had Colin called in with a sweet potato question. We have a question about sweet potatoes, which is good. And it comes from Eliza Kwanbeck, and she writes, "My boyfriend and I have been having an ongoing discussion about the difference between taro, tapioca, manioc, yam, and sweet potato. They spent a summer backpacking through Southeast Asia, taking cooking courses in every country we pass through." Yeah, that sounds nice.
Yeah, it does.
I'd like to do that. And in Malaysian Borneo, we took a cooking class and made Berber cha-cha, which sounds awesome. I've never had it or heard of it, but I'll eat anything called Berber cha-cha, which is a coconut yam taro porridge flavored with pandan leaves. I love pandan. Pandan is a leaf that has a little bit of a kind of a vanilla taste. For those of you that don't know, you can get it in Southeast Asian groceries, Thai groceries, anything like that. And it comes usually frozen, and sometimes the frozen one can have a little bit of a fishy taste when it's thawed out, but it's used in a lot of dessert preps. And we used to make a really good sugar cookie out of it. Instead of vanilla, we basically blitzed the leaves with butter, heated it, and decanted the butter off, and used that to make cookies. And they were like this amazing green color, like pistachio green color, and with that pandan flavor that you can't really replicate without the leaves, because I think the extracts are crap, the flavorings. Anyway, that's off topic, but delicious. And so she basically got into a bunch of arguments about what these different things are, what the different starches are, where they come from, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All right, Eliza. First of all, this has given me a great opportunity to pump a series of books that I think everyone should own, as many of as they can. And it's the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. That is Brooklyn Botanic Garden series. And they have a series of small guides that are all really, really cheap. You can get them online, actually, if you go to the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. If you become a member, they send you like 10 for nothing. And they're like, you can get them for like $5 to $12. books. I mean, they're amazing. But the one I'm going to talk about today, and it has snappy titles, which I really enjoy. I like a snappy title. It's called Buried Treasures, Tasty Tubers of the World. And what I like about these guides is you can read them kind of in one, you know, quick session. I don't know, when you're sitting on the hopper or something. It's only like 100 pages, a lot of good pictures, a lot of good information. And so I read it this morning, not on the hopper, please. But I recommend that series. They also have a really good book called The Best Apples to Buy and Grow. But here is my – and they have a lot of really more rare, interesting tubers, corms, rhizomes, everything in that book that you can go take a look at. But here's the quick breakdown. I know I'm going to get some of this wrong, so please no hate mail. You can just correct me if I'm wrong. The sweet potato, which I can't possibly pronounce the Latin name. It's like Ipomoea batatas. I can't pronounce it. Batatas. Anyway, sweet potato is from South America. It's been cultivated for many, many years, like 10,000 years. It went early pre-Columbian times, probably to Polynesia, and then after the Great Columbian Seed Exchange, whatever, went the other way over to Africa. It's grown all over the world. They grow a lot of it in China. It's fed to pigs. They make starch for noodles. It's incredibly delicious. The white varieties of it are still just a sweet potato. The boniatos are still, they're just sweet potatoes. They're the same style, different cultivars. They're less sweet. That is a sweet potato. Everything usually in a United States supermarket, things labeled yams are actually sweet potatoes. Luckily, the U.S. government requires it somewhere on the box. It also says sweet potato, even if it says yam. Okay, the actual yam, Dioscorea alata, is from East Asia, but it made it to Africa well over 1,000 years ago, and then from there to the West Indies, in the 1500s or so. There's many, many varieties of it. The yam is distinct, right? The yam, unlike the sweet potato, which can be eaten raw, the yam has to be cooked. Okay, you have to cook a yam. You can't eat it raw. I don't really know much about yam starch. I think most of the stuff that I see as starch is sweet potato starch, which is entirely different from potato starch, entirely different from tapioca, manioc, cassava starch, okay? So that's kind of sweet potato versus yam. Now, taro, right, Colocasia esculenta, right, you have to cook that stuff because it contains some calcium oxalate, I think. It's a corm. It comes from India but went to Southeast Asia a long, 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 long time ago, right? That's what taro chips are made out of. In Hawaii, that's what poi is made out of. Taro cakes you get in China, like that's all taro, right? There's a different thing called giant taro, right, that's from Sri Lanka that went also to the Pacific Islands. Also needs to be cooked because of calcium oxalate, and if you eat it, it'll taste like thousands of sharp little needles, and it's very unpleasant. Don't want to do it. You want to cook it to get rid of it. Sometimes you want to cook it. I think that's with a pinch of baking soda helps neutralize it, I think, but I'm not sure. I don't do a lot of work on it. Okay, then kind of the answer to taro from the South America is yautía, right? It's the same family as taro, and so basically, like yautía and taro, you can kind of interchange those two things, right? So that's that. Now, an entirely separate ball of wax is and these are all the same damn thing, just from different names, different places. Manioc, cassava, tapioca, and yuca, right? Those are all Manihot esculenta. I can't pronounce any of this, so please don't come back on me. These are relatively recent, i.e. like 1,000 BC. That's from South America, but it's spread all over the world. Now, there's two kinds, right? There's the sweet kind and then the not sweet kind. And they all contain certain amounts of compounds that turn into cyanide. So you definitely want to cook them. But all the varieties usually you buy in the supermarkets now, you can just cook them and eat them. You don't need to, grind them, soak them overnight to get rid of the cyanide compounds and wash them and then, and process them. But in the old days, you did or you'd die. Anyway, but most of the varieties that are cultivated now, you don't have to do that. And so that's where tapioca starch comes from, which is what they make the little pearls out of in bubble tea, to the best of my knowledge. And it's also tapioca starch is very interesting. It's a different shape starch from many other starches. It's got a characteristic what's called kettle drum shape. You're going to want to look – a good source for different starches is National Starch Corporation and or the International Starch Council, I think. It has a website. And the Egan Press mentioned earlier a book on starches, which you can get from the American Association Association of Cereal Chemists has a good stuff on tapioca starch. But tapioca starch, aside from its interesting kettle drum shape, is world renowned for being very bland. So it doesn't cause a lot of flavoring to things because it's bland. It also is used in puff snacks because it has very good expansion properties, because it has a nice amylose amylopectin breakdown. Anyway, also, those things, yuca, manioc, cassava, tapioca, you'll often find a thick coating of wax over it, because if not, they kind of turn to crap pretty quick in the supermarket. So how was that, Nastasia?
That was very informative.
Quick rundown?
Yeah.
Make any dang sense at all?
It did.
Did? All right.
Let's take another break before we get back to
All right. So listen, we're going to take another commercial break, but call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Cooking issues.
You feel good? Much bone, brother. How you feel, man?
I feel all right.
I call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, fella? Hey, Jeff. Sure getting down. Look at him. Ha. We're gonna have a bunk.
You know, we're going to talk. It's Cooking Issues. Welcome back. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. We actually had a question about our songs, and we're going to talk about them later. Mm-hmm. For those of you that actually know that song already, which, I won't spoil it. Okay, so we had a question about carbonation, one of my favorite things. I've never actually written about it on the blog. I guess just because most of the research I've done on carbonation, I did kind of so long before I had the blog that I just never bothered writing about it. But, you know, maybe someday, if I ever get the time, we'll write a primer on it. Again, I will write a primer on it is what I mean to say. So the question is, do you have any thoughts about the EC/ISI, like both are correct, but I think they're moving towards Nastasia. Which one?
EC.
They're moving towards EC.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on the EC Twist and Sparkle carbonation system? It seems like it solves a lot of the problems you have with soda siphons, and it's cheaper and smaller than the Soda Stream, but still does use small cartridges. Long term, I'd like to get a system with a 20-pound CO2 tank. And this is from Sam. And yes, Sam, you should get a 20-pound CO2 tank at the very minimum, a 5-pound CO2 tank, Sam. Minimum. Anyway, but I'm a student, and I'll probably be moving a few times in the next few years, so it's not practical to purchase at the moment. I'm also considering as a gift for my parents, who buy fizzy water by the case but are not going to be interested in driving around with big CO2 tanks. Hey, they're not that big, Sam. They're not that big. I live in a tiny, tiny apartment, right? I live in an 800-square-foot apartment with two rambunctious kids, and I have not one but two 20-pound CO2 tanks in there. Anyway, I'm not saying you have to do it. I'm not trying to make you feel bad. I'm just saying you can do it. I know you can do it, Sam. Anyway, a couple more questions I can't seem to find the answers to. How much water can I carbonate with the 8-gram cartridges the system comes with? Are the cartridges proprietary? Can they be purchased more cheaply from someone besides EC or in bulk, and how well does it work? Okay. I can't tell you that you can buy it from someone else, but all of those cartridges are pretty much the same. EC's, you know, guarantee – I shouldn't say this. I'm going to get my butt handed to me by the EC Corporation because I'm friends with those guys. But, you know, they claim that their cartridges are all very accurately weighed out, et cetera, et cetera. They're very pure. You can only get really one bottle of water out of the 8-gram cartridge, and therein is the rub. So for me, it's more of for bars who don't want to invest in a carbonation system to maybe do drinks. And for me to really carbonate a drink, it's going to take two cartridges because I have to blast off some of the stuff. And so I'd hate to say this, but I think if you're going to make a lot of seltzer at home and you want a smaller system, that, you know, it's going to cost a lot very quickly to run through cartridges if you're actually drinking a lot of soda water. And EC is going to come tear my head off, but I would definitely, in that situation, if you don't want to go for a 5 or 20-pound CO2 tank, I would go for the Soda Stream. I'm going to get my butt handed to me.
That's okay. You're telling the truth.
But I would go for the SodaStream. I know many people that have it who don't want to have the 520-pound CO2 tank, so you get a lot more charges out of the refill, because you're going to run through CO2 cartridges like the end of the world is coming with the Twist and Sparkle. Now, the advantage of the Twist and Sparkle is that you can do liquor and other things in it that they tell you with the SodaStream that you can't do because of foaming problems. I don't own a SodaStream, but I'm thinking that I can modify one to do drinks like pretty cheaply just by adding a little extender tube to it. But I would definitely consider getting the you can get the starting level SodaStream, I think, for under $100, like $79, and I think it'd pay for itself pretty quick in terms of chargers. But I've probably just cut off my nose to spite my face. We probably will never work for EC again. But Sam, those are my feelings. It works fine as long as you chill it. Really, really chill your liquids. Keep your levels accurate. But I usually put two chargers in to really get a really strong charge in it because I like it really, really, really fizzy. And so I really feel like you're going to blast through cartridges with it. I can't believe I'm saying this on air because I'm going to get in trouble. Anyway, here we have a caller. Caller, you are on the air.
Hi, I'm Brian. I'm calling from San Francisco. Happy New Year to you, Dave.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. So I have two questions, which are unrelated. I'm hoping you can answer them both. So I'll ask them both right now. And the first question is regarding distillation. I've noticed that there's a lot of kind of distillation equipment. I guess I'm sort of interested in making my own kinds of essential oils. I bought a number of essential oils from Mandy Aftel in the past.
Friend of cooking issues, by the way, Mandy Aftel.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. And I've used them, and they're really delicious. And so now I'm interested in sort of making my own. And I'm wondering what kind of setup you might recommend to begin to start making my own essential oils and hydrosols. So that's question number one. And the second question has to do with pectin. Which is, I've tried making my own pasta-free, and I haven't had a lot of success. And I've used a couple of different supermarket pectins over the counter. I've done some reading, and one was said that Certo, which was the liquid kind, I tried, and that was supposed to be okay. And the other was like Pomona's or Ramona's or something like that, and that was supposed to work, but I haven't had any success. So I'm hoping that you might be able to help me with that and give a little 101 on pectins.
All right, so
and some sources for getting them.
So let's go in reverse. What's your problem with it?
Not setting.
Huh. Not setting. And you're making sure that your acid levels are high enough and your sugar levels are high enough? I mean, the main thing with pectins...
I used it for, like, kumquat, you know, so it was pretty high acid.
But what about the sugar levels?
It was still pretty high.
Yeah,
I mean, I boiled it for a while.
Right, I don't have off the top of my head what the numbers are, but regular pectin in order to set needs very high solids level, and which means like a lot of sugars and also acids. Kumquat should be acidic enough to set it. Then the question is how high is the solids level, which is going to be then determined by the temperatures. Now, presumably, you're taking the temperature high enough that your solids level is going to be high enough. That could be a source of the problem, not taking the temperature high enough. Or if you took the temperature high enough, then adding another liquid that's going to dilute it back down below the solids level where it's going to set properly. You know, the different pectins you can get a lot of times are going to be apple-based or citrus-based. I don't know any of the store brands. I've never used any of them. I tend to use more of like the weirder ones for kind of hydrocolloid applications because that's what people ask me for. And those ones you can use in lower solids and with lower sugars, but they require things like calcium to set. That's one of the pectins they use for kind of low-sugar jams and things like that. Those are like, Those are different kinds, like low methoxyamidate, LMA, you might hear a call.
What kind of calcium do you, or how do you recommend adding the calcium to those?
Oh, you just add, like a gluconate. I use calcium lactate gluconate. It doesn't require that much. And there's low methoxy pectin. The problem is it's very sensitive to calcium levels, so that if you put too much, it's a problem, put too little. And there's low methoxyamidated, which is, it's a little more bulletproof. But regular pectin should work unless you don't have a solids content high enough, which means you're not cooking to a high enough temperature. This is the only thing I can think of.
When you say solids content, what do you mean by that?
So in other words, your jelly is a certain percent. Let's just break it. Forget all the flavors, right? There's acid, whatever, blah blah blah. But it's a certain percent sugar and a certain percent water, right? And so you need to have the solids content, i.e., sugar content, high enough for the pectin to gel properly. I mean, that's kind of that's what pectin needs. So the two classic things to go wrong with pectin based things are you don't have enough. The solids levels aren't high enough, the sugars aren't high enough, or the acid levels not high enough. And those are the two kinds of things that you always want to look to first. Now, what was the first question again? Because I had an answer to it in my head.
It has to do with distillation and essential oils.
Okay. Now, a lot of people want to use the stuff that I have, like a rotary evaporator, all the kinds of things for distillation for essential oils.
Too much money.
Well, not too much money. Yes, also, but also not effective. What you want to do for that is steam distillation, right? And so in a steam distillation setup, that's what I would buy. I've never done essential oil distillation, but I've considered buying a rig for it. And the good news is they're cheap and they're fairly effective. And what you're doing then is you're packing a column with your product, and you're basically boiling. Steam is going through it, rupturing the cells, and the steam is carrying with it the essential oils, recondensing on the other side. The oils will float to the top, or some to the bottom, depends. Some are actually heavier than water, right? And the stuff and the stuff that is left over that's water is the hydrosol. And so it's actually the main problem is your yields usually are quite low, but it's definitely something that can be done. It's legal. It's not illegal to do because you're not using alcohol for it. You're using water. And so I would go definitely check out steam distillation. You should be able to get a whole small rig to test on eBay, the parts for it, for under $100. You just want to make sure,
Well, I saw that there was some that were vacuum distillation. There was a couple of rigs that were, under $200.
For essential oils?
It didn't say. I mean, they were sort of chemistry type of equipment. I just typed in steam distillation, vacuum steam distillation, and there was a couple things that popped up on Amazon, actually.
Yeah.
They're not rotary evaporators, but would in that case, could you see, it being done under vacuum being helpful?
Well, I think it might. I've never done the test, but I think it might actually be detrimental. I mean, I get oils across when I'm doing rotovap distillation sometimes, but it's very small quantities and they're dissolved. Obviously, they're dissolved in alcohol because I'm doing it in alcohol, and a lot of these things are soluble in alcohol to a certain degree. And I do get ouzo kind of effects when I water stuff down and some stuff, so there is oil in there, right? But I think that the high temperature of the steam, which is helping to rupture the cells, is a benefit for the steam distillation. And I think that you might not get that kind of action if you put it under a vacuum, because the main thing a vacuum is going to do for you is lower the temperature at which everything boils. Now, you can get a more gentle result that way, but I don't think you're going to get a high enough yield of essential oil to really have it be worthwhile. I don't know. Now, you could try the one thing for essential oil extraction that I've tried only once or twice but haven't really had success with is butane extraction, which is used by potheads for doing making honey oil out of swag weed, and I have it, and the honeybee is the extractor they use for that, and I've tried it once and I wasn't able to get a good result, but that's another thing I like to try. But I would definitely go for a regular standard steam distillation rig, which is pretty cheap, and I think you're going to get good results. I haven't done enough experimentation to figure out how to do it at a low temperature. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
But
got it.
And the ones that are produced aren't really produced at a low temperature unless they're supercritical fluid CO2 extracted stuff anyway, and that's beyond most of our reaches, mine included. You know what I mean?
Okay, great. Sounds within my price range and worth experimenting with.
Definitely. And write back or call us and tell us how it works, all right?
I will, Dave. Okay, thanks a lot.
All right. Bye. Okay. So Jack, should we go to another one or should I just finish out our questions? What do you think? Should we go to another break or should I finish out my questions?
No, keep going. Yourself.
Keep going? Mm-hmm. Nice. Okay. So Ken, who wrote us about the Araby, AeroPress, the AeroPress coffee, he wrote back just basically talking to us about the AeroPress. The AeroPress, for those of you who know, was invented by the guy that invented the Araby. And it's basically a piston that you put coffee in and then you apply pressure to the piston and you force the water through the like a puck, a brewing puck. And it makes basically supposedly a very high quality of like a mocha style coffee, not true espresso. Ken writes that there's this interesting thing. He says, some AeroPress power users dramatically increase the danger or the drama of using an AeroPress by – and they're only $40. We got to order one. I meant to make a mental note to order one before I showed up on Amazon so I could say I've ordered it.
Did someone say they were going to let us borrow theirs?
I don't know. Anyway, some AeroPress power users dramatically increase the danger of using AeroPress by brewing with the machine upside down and using a polyester or metal filter instead of the paper filter to take full advantage of the bloom, the oil, you know, the coming out coffee oil that has some yummies in it, and you can preserve them by brewing upside down and flipping the device over on end. I suspect at least some people understandably conflate bloom with crema or maybe the benefits of crema. And very interesting. I hadn't thought about this. And basically, the point is that let's say you are a French press person, right? So you take coffee and you push he points me to a website which I'll just read a little bit from the website. And this is from, I didn't write down the person's name. You know why? It's because I'm an idiot. Oh, Scott Markhart. Anyway, the AeroPress gives its user unprecedented control over brewing variables, yielding a great cup of coffee, but there's trouble in paradise. It has a shortcoming. Fans of the venerable French press will understand immediately because they are accustomed to a cup that offers a complex flavor of coffee's natural oils. They are lost in paper filtration systems like the AeroPress. On the other hand, many people do not enjoy the fines that a French press delivers in the brew. They embitter the bottom of the cup as they cause over-extraction there, and they have a bad mouthfeel. So we're caught between a rock and a hard place. And so what he does is he flips the AeroPress over, runs it in reverse. And I've always had a lot of problems with French press in general, one of which is that you can pack the grounds down at the bottom. The other is that they don't offer temperature control, which is dumb. The only attempt at a temperature controlled thing similar to a French press was the Clover, and that cost like $17,000 or something absurd like that until Starbucks bought them. I don't even know who the heck has them anymore. Anyway, So that's an interesting question. So now I'm mentally this morning spent an hour or so just sitting around thinking about how to make a French press / Araby that had all of the good results that without having stuff spraying all over my shirt. So Ken, there definitely will be more thinking and talking on the AeroPress and its kin in the future. I'm definitely going to be researching that in the new year. okay. Now, sorry, folks, flipping through the thing. We have, by the way, if you call in the next 10 seconds, I will give you a free pork chop. And really? You will have the last, and I just made that up, but I will. I'll give them a free pork chop. Anyway, we had an interesting question, and it's a non-cooking related question. And I think I'll round out on that. I'm making sure that I'm not missing anyone else's questions. Oh, I am missing someone's questions. Sorry, folks. We have Howard from Montreal writes in and say he just started listening to the show over the holidays and he's loving every minute of it. Thank you. He basically listened to the Berlin show and we talked then about a mixture of sodium chloride and calcium chloride to reduce sodium intake. And he says that his aunt uses this and basically he's wondering whether or not and we were talking about like adding ions to things to basically increase the volatiles, et cetera, et cetera. And he was saying, I'll just read it word for word rather than try to paraphrase it because I'm butchering what he's trying to say. So the effects I'm talking about, altering the solubility of volatiles, brining meat, bread, all seem to be related to ionic strength of the liquid. The higher the ionic strength, the more polar the aqueous phase, which in turn drives off organics. Similarly, in high ionic strengths, will alter the tertiary structure of proteins, such as gluten and bread. The brining process is slightly different, but the salt is driven into the meat, et cetera, et cetera. Assuming this theory is true, any soluble compound should be used instead of salt to achieve these effects. However, I think the shielding effects of salt ions play an important role in the disruption of tertiary protein structure. As such, KCl should be a close substitute for NaCl, although MgCl2 might be preferred in certain situations, but then you run into coagulations due to the divalent cation, magnesium's divalent cation. Anyway, what are your thoughts? I don't have that many thoughts on it, only to say that it's not only Howard, I just wanted to read this because I'm not ignoring your question. I haven't I haven't thought about it, and I don't have enough time to think about it on air right now, right, Nastasha?
Right.
But I will think more about it. Obviously, there's certain things that different cations, for instance, calcium has specific results with specific systems like hydrocolloids. Sodium has a certain result. But obviously, just shifting the ionic balance of whatever you're going to do with is going to mess with the protein structure. But I haven't thought enough about it to really know. But yes, you know, for instance, when you're brining something, actually kind of like polyphosphates tend to even alter the water binding of protein more than regular sodium. Like sodium polyphosphates tend to alter the binding quite a bit more. So they're not probably all the same, but yes, they all work somewhat. Now, that's like a long rambling bunch of stuff from Dave Arnold in the New Year's having his brain go on Fritz in the middle of the radio. But here's a question I can answer, and it comes from Paul, and it's not a cooking related question. It's, what are the two pieces of music on the Cooking Issues Radio Show podcast? There, and it's interesting. He thinks it's Fish is Vodka is the intro, is what he said. Which I love. Fish is Fish. It's a great book. I used to read that to my kids all the time. Fish is Fish. We're going to have a fun, good time, which is the one that is in the middle of the show. And you haven't had much luck Googling the songs. Okay, I'm going to do it in reverse. The one in the middle is Doing It to Death by James Brown, sometimes called Have a Funky Good Time, but that's not what it is. It's called Doing It to Death. And that song was released in 1973, and it's with the JBs, and it's amazing. It's got Maceo Parker, it's got Fred Thomas, and the reason James Brown got me through many, many, many years, like late nights in the studio, welding at 4 a.m. I would crank songs like that to get me kind of like over the hump when you're passing out into your welding mask as you're building like large sculptures alone, which you should never do. You should always have someone with you in the shop when you're working. But Doing It to Death is one of those songs that it's just so tight, and he beats on a rhythm so long, and it's just a and it's just like minutes of this bump jump, and so I that kind of song just keeps me going. And it's what's famous for, even though we never play it on this section on the radio, it's famous for a section, and the song's in F, and in the middle of the song James Brown says, okay, we're going to take it to D, down D, funky D, and then boom, D, bam, they take it down to D, and it's just an amazing, it's an amazing transition, and it's like all of other, great James Brown songs, is that he can take it to a really high level, and then change it, and somehow that goes into an even higher level. I mean, miracle worker with bridges like that, and so he was incredibly influential to me from a musical standpoint, and so I had to pick a James Brown song. And we chose doing it to Death. And so you can find it there. And maybe sometime next time we'll play the down D, funky D, mm-hmm. skanking D, down D part, which is fantastic. By the way, I guess it doesn't mean you're a bad person if you don't like James Brown, right?
It doesn't mean you're associated with.
No, but it definitely means there is something wrong with your funk motor. the intro song is a little known song by Amos Milburn called "Vicious Vicious Vodka." Although I like Fish's Vodka quite a bit.
Yeah.
And Amos Milburn, who died in 1980, became somewhat popular in Los Angeles after World War II. And he wrote a lot of songs about liquor. Vicious Vicious Vodka is actually not one of his best known ones. But he had Bad Bad Whiskey is a great song. But a lot of songs about drinking. He also wrote a famous song called The Chicken Shack. And he was kind of a contemporary of other people like Louis Jordan or Charles Brown, who did some amazing work. Louis Jordan, you might know from Beans and Cornbread, or actually not as famous, I'm just picking food songs. But Amos Milburn, his best-known song is actually not best-known by him, and it's One Scotch, One Bourbon, and One Beer, which you probably know the John Lee Hooker version of and not the Amos Milburn version of. So apparently he did not actually have an alcohol problem, although all of his songs were – he did another one. I think he did Milk and Water, which is basically means I'm not drinking right now because I'm back on milk and water because the doctor says that my liver will fall out if I continue to drink. So that is Vicious Vicious Vodka, or in my head now forever, Fish is Vodka. Come back next week and listen to us. Cooking Issues. Corner.
20 minutes late. You got my head all twisted, and I just can't get it straight. Vicious, vicious vodka. Oh, you dirty rat. Got me on this corner, and I don't know where I'm at. I had a chance to swap you for a little gin. Now when my baby sees me, she's gonna bust my head.